And welcome back to the SEC on CBS podcast here on CBS Sports. I am your host, Chip Patterson. We've got a great show for you today. Dennis Dodd joins, and he had a conversation with Nick Saban. You've got to hear what the Alabama coach thinks about some of these rule changes, thinks about what to expect from this team moving forward, and why they might have been let down in the national championship game. Plus, we get into some of the most interesting players for next year's NFL draft class, including a quarterback from a school that you might not expect. Make sure that you subscribe on iTunes so that you can get the SEC on CBS podcast first, and enjoy another Doddcast. Back here on the SEC on CBS podcast, I'm Chip Patterson, joined by Dennis Dodd, therefore deeming this a Doddcast. Hello, Dennis, how are you doing?
Chip, how are you? I am great.
We haven't gotten a chance to catch up in a little while, but this is a fun time because it's talking season. Talking season is when your resident message board guru is able to get a conference realignment rumor to levitate all the way to having athletic directors address it. But it's also a time when I think that the coaches are more willing to speak to us. You know, this is when we will get some of the most candid and some of the most interesting conversations on the record from these coaches and off. But a couple of things that we want to get to later. We are beginning to work on speaking to some of these coaches anonymously, and we're getting some very interesting takes from that. I know, Dennis, you've already heard some interesting things. I want to get your take, Dennis, on Josh Allen. A quarterback who you've been doing, you were really one of the first to start opening up the story about this player who, in the Mountain West, is where we will find one of the top future pro prospect quarterbacks. But first, you got the time of the man that is Nick Saban, Dennis. So honored. How was he?
He was great. He was uncommonly frank. And this is a story I wrote for, I think, Tuesday, and by phone. And he was as I said, very frank. I just asked him a series of questions that he ran with. And I was surprised in a couple of responses. He said, I said, look, you lost by 4 points with a second to go. How do you measure progress? You weren't exactly chopped liver. And he said there was a lack of ownership and togetherness, quote unquote, between the SEC title game and the playoff. And it didn't hit me right away, but I should have followed up. I assume that's talks about Lane Kiffin.
Right.
But ownership and togetherness doesn't suggest altogether a wacky offensive coordinator. So it's much the same language he used in
after the Ohio State loss.
In 2010, after they won the national championship, and then had the temerity to go 10-3 in the follow-up year, you know, he spent a whole offseason basically blasting that team for not buying in, and they won 10 games. So part of that is the standard that is set at Alabama. Part of that is Nick Saban wanting to win everything, every time, every year.
Do you think that he sees opportunity for improvement with these teams, like as he moves, you know, from one group to the next, you still, one of the things that I think is going to make Alabama the number one team in the preseason polls is the fact that there are a lot of pieces that are coming back. You still have a Jalen Hurts, a Bo Scarborough, Mika Fitzpatrick, Ronnie Harrison, Deron Payne, like a lot of key figures that played a lot of big snaps, including your SEC Offensive Player of the Year back. You know, when you're blasting your old team, is that part of the break them down and build them up for the next campaign, I guess?
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think they'll be preseason number one. And look, Nick, this isn't the first time Nick would have used the media to get his point across to his players. You can bet if he's telling me that, some sort of similar message is being communicated inside those walls because they – you know, they didn't win at all. And there are, look, everything you mentioned is true, but there are signs to be concerned about on judging by Alabama standards. Brian Daboll is his sixth offensive coordinator in 11 seasons. He's lost 7 assistants the last 2 years total. It's been a pretty seamless transition. And every offensive coordinator, it seems, that's gone in there has succeeded and won SEC championships, if not rings or both. But I think one point he did make that, you know, I wrote a column earlier this year saying Brian Daboll has a lot to live up with, to live up to because of Lane Kiffin's accomplishments on the field. If you just take those accomplishments, three different quarterbacks, three SEC champions. But again, Nick, unsolicited, we offered to me that we need to get back to more pro style passing concepts. Well, Brian Daboll brings that from the New England Patriots. So I was kind of surprised at that. We were crazy out of the spread last year. I thought they were pretty effective out of the spread, given that Jalen Hurts was in the same year he was being broken in, if you will, quote unquote, as a freshman in the SEC, and that in that context was also chasing a national championship. I thought it did well. So we're going to see some different things, at least offensively. Now I think it's confirmed out of the offense.
Yeah, and I've just started to imagine that the development that Jalen Hurts, you know, may or may not have made with the vertical passing game combined with just will Robert Foster be the speedster, top-notch recruit, 4.3 speed type guy that so many are expecting and you're sort of imagining a step forward for him? Maybe. I think chances are good. I think Calvin Ridley's going to have a good season. I think Jerry Jeudy's going to be absolutely tremendous. Like, the things are setting up so that Alabama is going to be in the college football playoff again unless something crazy happens.
Yeah, because the mere fact that you know, who's the second best team in the SEC, and it's not this, you know, multiple choice question that, wow, well, I don't know. It's more like, well, is there a second best? You know, it's I guess it's Auburn.
I guess it's, you know, Florida.
I guess it's Florida. It kind of starts with that kind of conversation. And it'd be nice if the SEC East checked in every once in a while by winning the league. So really all they have to do is win the West. I don't see somebody rising out of the East somehow this year all of a sudden and winning the SEC. So when those are parameters, yeah, I would agree with you.
Do you think that all right, so Nick Saban's always jumped in one way or another whenever the things are changing within college football, especially. That's another thing that happens around this time of year. Legislation always getting looked at. What's your vibe from him? I know he mentioned the recruiting rules that are starting to change. Where do you think he places himself in those discussions? Because, you know, he was alleged, along with Bielema, to have tried to do some, I imagined it like a whip, like in politics, like he was going around at the coaches' conventions collecting votes or something like that to try and make sure that some of the this was for pace of play concerns, substitutions, But you know, is he getting back in the mix, politicking with the new changes to the recruiting rules, some of the thoughts on staff sizes and such?
Well, you know, all politics are local. And when, gosh, this is at least 10 years ago, when it was determined about 10 years ago when head coaches couldn't go out on the road and recruit this time of year, right at this time of year, he threw a fit. A guy like Charlie Weiss threw a fit because he was really good on the road. Pete Carroll threw a fit because he's really good on the road. And it's the same type of thing. With what particularly bothers Nick in this package, and there was a lot of them, this package of legislation that was passed last month is you know, the provision that a high school coach can't be hired that is related to a player 2 years before he enrolls or 2 years into his time at the school. They cannot work camps, and he's really against that because he is in the business of building, you know, giving people a step up and giving people a second chance and giving people a chance. You can see by the analysts he hires. And he's got a good point. But as I pointed out to him on the phone call, you know, many times these rules are put in because someone's abused the privilege. You know, mm-hmm. coaches have been hired to land a player.
Oh, look, another Paramus High School coach just got hired at Michigan.
It's happened in basketball for a long, long time.
Isn't Danny Manning the sort of like flagship cornerstone of that?
1984. Ed Manning was a long haul trucker, and amazingly got hired as one of the three assistants on the bench for Larry Brown at Kansas. And his son just happened to be what is now, I guess, what a Hall of Fame basketball player, Danny Manning, who helped them win a national championship. So that was as blatant as it got. And so I think that's been outlawed in basketball, the high school coach thing. And Ed Manning wasn't even that. What they're trying to do is outlaw it in football. And he railed against that. At the end of his mini rant, he said, "I know I'm crazy. You can tell everybody I'm crazy." So there you go.
Somehow, I don't know how Josh Pastner got around it, because remember Josh Pastner had the Lawson dad on his Memphis staff. But I think that you have a fantastic point there. The reason that these even have to be addressed is that they're being abused. But then there's also one note that I saw from your conversation with Saban. Brian Daboll, who we've discussed on this podcast, you know, what do we expect from him? He's just going to, you know, follow the marching orders. I am a little bit more interested when you pointed out, and he mentioned that, you know, he was working as a graduate assistant with other coaches, other graduate assistants that have gone on to become head coaches in the NFL. And Nick painted Brian Daboll to be an equal of those coaches who just hasn't really caught the right breaks. And I thought that was really, really interesting. It's unfortunate that once the season starts, all Alabama assistant coaches are thrown into the dungeon to study film and aren't allowed to talk to the media. But this is a fascinating character introduced to the Alabama story.
Yeah, the last time their paths crossed was 98-99 when Brian Daboll was a GA, a young GA at Michigan State. And among their four GAs were him, Josh McDaniels, Adam Gase, and I forget the fourth. There was a fourth who was a big name as well. And Nick had obviously stayed in touch with him. Obviously, he worked for Bill Belichick. The offenses Brian Daboll did work at and coordinate at Miami and Kansas City, I think, among others, were not good. They finished in the 20s or low 20s in total offense, but he had some really mediocre quarterbacks. He's got obviously probably the top one in the SEC and obviously one of the best ones in the nation now. And I think the natural progression of any quarterback in his second year means he'll be better. So I think he'll be fine. I mean, these, aside from Lane Kiffin, who was really good at his job, you know, let's face it, there hasn't been that lightning rod surrounding the Alabama offensive coordinator. They've done well. You know, McElwain won two rings. Lane did well on the field. You know, they did okay, and I suspect Brian Daboll will too.
I think that the lasting legacy for all of the 2 years that Lane Kiffin was at Alabama's offensive coordinator, I think with Blake Sims, he signaled to the recruiting world and to high school players and to high school coaches that the Alabama quarterback doesn't need to look and play like Greg McElroy.
No.
And Greg McElroy is great, but like, I think that you've got a long, 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 long history of not having dynamic playmakers at the quarterback position
at
Alabama.
That's right.
Decades long. And all of a sudden, you know, things have changed, and it is great for Alabama football. Well, everything's good for Alabama football, but I think that'll be Lane's lasting legacy.
I think you're right. Blake Sims was a fifth-year senior who had been converted, I think, to running back and receiver, and under Lane's tutelage set the Alabama single-season record for total offense.
Mm.
You know, last year, Jalen Hurts,
True freshman,
for better or worse, went whole hog into the spread. I think Nick realizes now, or has realized, you know, you're raising the specter of the game manager. if you have a quarterback, you have a chance. And I think that that's why the SEC fell off last year, because too many teams didn't have one. You know, Hugh Freeze pulled the red shirt off Shea Patterson just to get him ready for this season. Now, who knew they were going to self-impose a bowl ban? But still, he was the number one quarterback in high school coming out in recruiting. So, you know, the leading returning passer in the league is Drew Locke, in total passer and total offense at Missouri. So if you've got a it's always been the case in modern football. If you have a quarterback, you have a chance, except in the SEC. And then they finished, you know, they didn't win a championship. Everybody lost four games but Alabama. And I would submit we're probably the third best conference last year. But that's another potty.
Well, all right, well, let's tell me this, put you on the spot. Who do you think, aside from Jalen Hurts, who is, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways to look at Jalen Hurts against other quarterbacks, but aside from Jalen Hurts, who do you think is the best SEC quarterback going into 2017?
Ooh, that's good. Well, Jacob Eason is going to have to make a step. He was a 55% passer last year. There's a lot of faith in Felipe Franks at Florida. I don't put much faith in LSU and Danny Etling.
Nope.
I really like Jarrett Stidham at Auburn, because I don't think it's much of a reach to say this is going to be the most efficient Auburn offense and most powerful since Nick Marshall, since they haven't had basically anything since then. They return the leading rusher in college football, the leading returning rusher in college football, Cameron Petway, Kerryon Johnson. Jarrett Stidham in limited action as a freshman at Baylor threw for, I think, 1,200 yards, maybe 1,500 yards. I saw him live a few times and was really, really impressed. I just think he fits perfectly in that offense. He won't run, nor will he be asked to run like Nick Marshall, but he's mobile enough. I think they'll do great things.
Two quarterbacks that you did not mention that I think are very, very interesting. Number one, Austin Allen, who has a chance to be very, very productive. Obviously, Arkansas's offense in general, huge loss with Raleigh Williams retiring from football after another neck injury in spring practice. And the other one, and this is, you know, we're putting together an SEC preview magazine at CBS Sports, which will be found in print on newsstands. Long live print. As I was going through that, man, I like Nick Fitzgerald. I don't know if I like Mississippi State to win eight games, but I like Nick Fitzgerald to put together one of these incredible dual threat seasons where all of a sudden he's going to have, like, remember when Dak really got rolling and all of a sudden his numbers were starting to rival Tim Tebow? And now, I don't know if Nick Fitzgerald is going to break records, but I think he's going to have some crazy stat lines. And Mississippi State might lose games like 48-42, but I think they're gonna have no trouble scoring the football.
I forgot to mention Nick Fitzgerald. He's the number three rushing quarterback in the country behind Lamar Jackson. And I forget who was number two, but he was number three with over 1,300 yards. Now, he's going to have to get better as a passer,
for sure,
but I think he very quietly made great steps last year. And I'll tell you this: a great follow up to Dak Prescott at Mississippi State. They didn't fall off the map.
They run some of the same run pass option stuff. Like it is a very similar scheme. And a note that I sort of took, and I think I will continue to use as one of my closing refrains for Nick Fitzgerald is, you know, if his body can take the punishment for an entire season, more power to him, because he runs.
Yeah.
He runs in the open field a lot, and if he can sustain it and play for a whole season, I think he will be very, very successful.
Yeah, I think the conclusion is that the SEC is just better at quarterback, so it will be better overall. And really, the only league where that sort of thing counts, and I'm talking about conference pride. Even in the Big Ten, you don't hear people yelling, Big Ten, Big Ten, Big Ten. It's important to people, this subject we're talking about. The SEC has to be great for those who follow it.
The ACC cares.
The ACC cares, but not as much as the SEC. Having said that, the ACC, as we sit here, by far and away, right now is the best conference in the country. I don't think there's any question about that.
I think the ACC cares because of the BCS era. because the ACC struggled in the BCS era, except for winning the first, not the first, the second and last BCS title. Because they lost in so many BCS bowl games, and because the SEC, which they share a geographic footprint and many traditional rivalries, I think there was just too many times where people were going to the office and hearing that SEC chant down the hallway. And so when the ACC finally got it rolling, now the ACC is on you know, their conference pride with two national championships in the last 4 years. And as they are, you know, so excited about everything that they've got going, there's also the fact that they're losing a lot of quarterbacks. Lamar Jackson is back, but the best thing that the ACC has going is their defenses.
Yeah, Miami's going to be, I'm told, their front seven on defense is really going to be salty, which may carry them through. Because, that, again, that Coastal Division is another, you know, throw a dart. You know, you can't say, well, this is the obvious favorite. North Carolina loses Trubisky and Switzer. Miami loses Kaya and much of their running game. So, you know, you don't know who's going to win it. It would be nice for Miami after 13 years in the league to win a division title. That'd be great. But the point is, I think North Carolina's got it going with Fedora. I don't think there's any question. They have the number one quarterback taken in the draft. That's going to help them monumentally in recruiting. Miami, I think, is on a roll with Richt. I think he's going to finish his career there. There's depth there. Virginia Tech, Justin Fuente. It's going to be tough. You know, 9-3 in bowls. I mentioned the draft success. They are, you know, the ACC annually now, Chip, you know, this is number two in draft picks.
Yep.
And it's not even close.
But you know what school, and I'm probably picking Miami to win the Coastal as well because of their front seven, and because I look up and down that division, and you know what? I will gladly take egg on my face. Everyone loves to make fun of the people who pick Miami when Miami does not get to Charlotte. But I'm going to say it. This is the year that Miami gets to Charlotte. I think that this is going to be an interesting thing, because Miami was in that kick of most draft picks without the success in college. Like, that was the big critique of the ACC was that you were getting 4- and 5-star recruits and you were producing NFL draft picks, but while they were in college, you weren't able to translate that into on-field success. And Miami really has been the poster of that in terms of high recruiting, high draft picks, and a whole bunch of Sun Bowls.
What do you think? In other words, the Les Miles of the ACC, although Les Miles won a national championship and is the school's winning as coach. That's another discussion for right. another time. I may post a Twitter poll, because that's a good – I'm going to be in Miami next month and talk to Mark and, you know – what do readers think is the best angle to pursue there? I wouldn't be opposed to that. And you just gave a great bullet point. Should it be the disparity between the draft picks and on-field success, which is one of the things, along with low attendance, that will get coaches in hot water more than anything?
Because,
you know, it's like, you know, why can't, or a guy blows up in the NFL, why couldn't we win this with this guy? Well, you know, that hit. Now, it's not like it was in 2001, but it's still South Florida, and they are athletes, and they are getting to the NFL, not in the same numbers. But why has Miami never won so much as a division title in the ACC? So, you know, I think I'll do a Twitter poll. We'll come up with, you know, we don't even have to list the possible angle. Just say, I'm going there next month. What do you think's the best angle to pursue?
I think that is Miami going hard on staff size right now?
Or what do you mean, big on staff size?
Big on staff size.
I've got the numbers right here. I don't think they were one of the bigger ones mentioned, but that's another whole thing even to talk about. I think this survey I wrote about earlier this week is at best incomplete and at worst inaccurate. In fact, I know it's inaccurate. I'm looking up Miami right now. 29, according to this very, very preliminary study by the NCAA, 29. The most in the ACC, believe it or not, is Syracuse with 37.
That blew my mind.
Yeah, I know.
Is it because they're the only ones that were being honest when they reported?
Well, that's another question. When they dig down on this study that they're going to spend the rest of the year doing, what compels any school to even cooperate? Because it's like, here's one reason. You know, how many schools have volunteers? They're not even paid. You know, I hear anecdotal evidence of schools, you know, who wouldn't want Miami on their resume, or Alabama, or USC, or Michigan? Get some high school kid in there to break down film and don't pay him. You know, it's on like an unpaid internship. Does that count? Does that even count? Do you have to report that? So they've got to set the parameters for the reporting itself before they start to dig down on staff size. My point is, in the NCAA is going to spend the rest of the year looking at perhaps how to limit staff size. I'm not sure if legally they can. The NCAA is not sure legally if they can, but they're going to take a deep down dig and look at it.
Do you think that it's a problem if they are using volunteers and if these staff sizes are exploding?
Yeah, I'll just reflect what I've been told. Again, you know, it's something very hard to quantify, and it's been going on for years. But Mac Brown was a strident guy against it. He would talk about the polo shirts on the sidelines. You know, some of them are wearing headphones. Well, what do they all do? They're all wearing the same, you know, they're on the team. Who are those guys?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what got him interested. And then he ended up hiring Alabama's number two guy as one of their off-field coaches as the director of player personnel. That's another story. Is it a problem? I'll say this. There are many coaches that are worried about a competitive advantage. In other words, hey, we can only afford three. Who knows how many Alabama has? That's not fair. Well, that would be countered with those who would say, well, there's a reason why Alabama has a 100,000-seat stadium and Middle Tennessee's is only 50, or their weight room is 17,000 square feet. And, you know, we have to go in shifts in our weight room because it's not big enough. It's, you know, it is what it is. I have another coach tell me, you know, look, just give us a number because it's all over the map. Make it four, make it 50, but give us a number because now it's just the wild, wild west out there.
There's got to be at some point, I think that when you ask for an athletic department and athletic director to invest heavily in these supersized staffs, you are making a bet on it being able to pay off into your success. And I tend to believe that the laws of competition will somehow even each other out, and that, you know, if a coach decides that he wants to be reckless and blow out his staff size, well, you know, then maybe there's going to be too many cooks in the kitchen, and maybe it won't breed the kind of success. As, you know, crazy and paranoid as coaches are about getting every detail and breaking down tape, these are still 18 to 22-year-olds that need to execute it out on the field. Like you said, I mean, Michigan went to Rome and you went to Juniper Beach. Like, that's just the way that it is in college football. The key is being able to do what so far we've only seen, you know, football powerhouses that have been established, like an Alabama or an Ohio State do, which is combine a heavy investment in these support systems with on-field success and national championships.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, there is a point of diminishing returns, I think, with all this. And one coach reminded me that the New England Patriots are one of the leanest and meanest organizations in the NFL. He said, I think they've got like nine coaches in a league where I think it's pretty unlimited, all the support staff you can bring in. I'm not sure of that, but, you know, that sounds, and they are pretty successful. You know, in this study that I got a hold of, Notre Dame had 45 staff members. I don't think anybody believes that Notre Dame might be up there, but I don't think they have the most. You know, I had PJ Fleck tell me in Minnesota, he's got none. In terms of support.
Right.
Not, you know, you have, the static numbers are on-field coaches, strength and conditioning, which everybody's allowed five, grad assistants, everybody's allowed four, and then everything else. So, yeah, I guess there does have to be some sort of some sort of uniformity there.
Well, one school that does not have the same resources as a Michigan, Alabama, or Ohio State is Wyoming. But what Wyoming does have that those other schools don't have right now is one of the consensus top pro prospect quarterbacks in all of college football. Josh Allen is a fascinating story going into this season to me, Dennis, and you did this story. Props to you. It was a great story, and it's gotten us already primed for being caught off guard, you know, during draft season or later in the year. Like the, with the Carson Wentz example, there was, you know, sort of getting caught off guard by it. I feel like the spotlight is on Josh Allen now. I think it's great for Craig Bohl in Wyoming, and I think it's great for the Mountain West. I'm sure they are very happy. I'm sure that the CBS Sports Network, as I would say, is a good company, man. It's very happy that we're going to get some NFL prospect, NFL draft junkies tuning in to watch the Cowboys this season. What'd you get from Allen, and what are you expecting going into the year?
Well, this kind of blew up at the beginning of the month when everybody, or the end of April and beginning of May, when everybody's doing their draft projections for 2018. And then I began to see this Josh Allen name on there, who I was barely aware of. I will be honest with you, at Wyoming. And so then I'm in Phoenix for the Fiesta Summit, and there's about seven conferences there, including Craig Bohl, who's the Wyoming coach. And I cornered him. I said, "What's this kid all about?" And he starts telling me this story about how this country boy from Central Valley of California drives a beat up pickup. And then you start realizing that Craig Bohl was a guy who coached Carson Wentz at North Dakota State, and there's several similarities. And then you watch him on film, and I watch some of his games. Man, his arm. And that's, I'm sure, what the NFL is in love with. He's very mobile. He's big. He's 6'5", 236, and mobile for that size, not necessarily a runner, but can just spin it and fit, you know, can throw it into a window. And is really, really good. The story that Craig Bohl loves to tell is that he threw Josh Allen threw an interception against San Diego State in the Mountain West Championship game, and he threw, I think, 13 or 15 this year. He needs to work on that. And, you know, instead of pouting and standing there, he was so disgusted with himself, he ran the guy down, this San Diego State defensive back, stripped him at about the 3, and Wyoming recovered the end zone for a touchback because of his hustle. And he comes to the sideline all pissed off, his face covered in blood, and Craig Bohl's just shaking his head because he loves it. You know, he hates the interception, but he loves the hustle. And those kind of stories will build draft lore around a guy who right now is, we should say, is ranked either the first or second player, forget quarterback, player taken in next year's draft.
Because the heat started for Trubisky late.
Yes.
Mitch Trubisky was not taken seriously as the top quarterback to be drafted until later in the season.
Right. Because it was such an average class that you were waiting for intangibles to show up. Okay. Mitch Trubisky started every game. It was really consistent, blah, blah, blah. Patrick Mahomes at number 10 to the Chiefs. But overall, it was rated a very average class where not one guy stood out. But go ahead.
No, I mean, I was just trying to think about the way that this unfolds, the way that the NFL draft sometimes matches up with college football, and how sometimes college football stars, regardless of what's going on the field, can demand that spotlight. I think because last year was a big season for Craig Bohl with Wyoming, and the prospect and the player that was getting a lot of attention offensively was Brian Hill, the running back.
Yeah.
And running the ball, putting up these big numbers on the scoreboard. Josh Allen was a part of that. And now that same system, the same system from North Dakota State, everything's really coming together to the point where this is in, if you want to talk about below the radar storylines that are not, what will Alabama do? Is USC going to capitalize on all this hype? I think that, is Craig Bohl about to take Wyoming football, and make it one of these, 9-10 win teams that is threatening for a New Year's Six spot? I think that could be huge.
Yeah. No, I agree. I and I touched on it in the story a little bit, but there's a lot more there. He flipped. Josh Allen actually flipped. He was coming out and then decided not to. He went back and forth. It was really a tough decision. In fact, his mother told me they were being bombarded, not only during the bowl game last year, but during the season by agents.
Wow.
So the agents were seeing this. They were getting a whiff of how good, sign with us when you're ready to come out, which is, they're allowed to do as long as no money changes hands. They can get advice from agents. She led me to believe it was really, really dragging on them, that everybody was all over them. So he would have been a high choice had he come out. Now, in this year's draft, I'm told it's much deeper, and maybe that's the point. Maybe he'll make, maybe it will be better for him in a deep draft. I don't know, but he is what he is right now, a top five pick.
Mm, good stuff. He is Dennis Dodd. Make sure you follow him on Twitter at Dennis Dodd CBS. Dennis, we will take next week off and then probably link back up. We've got a lot more stuff to get to. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Chip.